Okay, everybody get a donut? Good. All right, you're welcome. So, I still got to bring in some gummy bears, but... Okay, so we're going to finish up the V101, and then we will... I got about a half a dozen sample questions that I sent around, and I will go through those, let you guys kind of chat about them, and then we'll put the answer up on the board for them. And I'll kind of explain how my test works, so you can understand. I mean, they're all multiple guesses. There's some true and false, part of what I try to do is I want you guys to think. So, like, you'll see some questions where it's like, it's not necessarily what I exactly lectured on, but it's like I talk about this provision, so I want you to think about the provision and see how it applies. So I got a couple of those up there as well. So we'll go through that. Where we left off, we had just finished Article 5. We were talking about owner's responsibility. We're going to get through all the rest of it, obviously. Article 6 talks about the cost of the work. If you guys recall, way back when we were talking about in Article 3, there was a provision where I put it up in all blue, and it says, see Article 6.3. So we're going to talk about that today, and there's some other stuff about where the definitions are and how you understand the cost of the work for the project. So, a lot of the stuff is pretty basic, but the purpose of contracts and the purpose of how this contract, because every 10 years it's revised and everything else, is when things come up that maybe everybody thinks simple and understand, there's been litigation about it. So they put something in to make it clarify. So this one's pretty simple because we've learned cost of work has been the same for decades, probably over 100 years. The cost of work is the same. So it's the total cost to the owner to construct all elements of the project designed or specified by the architect and shall include contractor's general conditions, cost, overhead, and profit. So it's just about, again, like I said last week, it's about what it takes to build the project or build the building. Because the project, and I don't know if I broke this down well enough last week, so I'm going to kind of give you, there's three kind of terms that you want to think about of who they apply to. The work with a capital W applies to the contractor. That's what they do. They do the work, and all their subcontractors do the work. Services with a capital S is what an architect does. They provide services. So if you see a contract, and this is something that I'll see from time to time, I'll get a contract where someone has drafted it, and they call the work when it's an architectural agreement. And I'll change it all to services. The reason being is because throughout construction, industry standard terms come into play. Common law. And so when we go in that hierarchy, all the way down is common law. And so you want to keep consistency. So when I see a contract for one of my clients and it's talking about architectural services, but it says work with a capital W, I modify that because then the contractors, what are they doing? So we don't want to have duplication. So you have the work, you have services. Then you have what's called the project. Now a lot of people, and you'll see also contracts where the project, with a capital P, and the work become interchangeable. You don't want to do that because the project may include more than the work. You're like, well, I don't understand that, because aren't they building the building? Is that with the project? Yes, but for the owner's purpose, the owner may, let's take my example of the hotel where they have the specialty restaurant, okay? The work is what the contractor's building. They're not building the specialty restaurant. The architect is also providing services for not the specialty restaurant. So those services and those work have nothing to do with that. But the owner, when they're doing this, their project will include the specialty restaurant. So the project is an over-umbrella that includes cost of the services, cost of the work, cost of other work, other services, and everything else. So for an owner's purposes, the project covers everything. It's the largest umbrella. And then what you'll see in contracts when they talk about the project with capital P, it's not the work. So this doesn't say cost of the project. And for here, the cost of the work relates to the contractor. Let's say here. So this has here is plural, contractors. You'll see also throughout the B101 and the A201 and most agreements, normally the term contractor is a capital C because you identify who the contractor is. But here you want to identify there may be more than one contractor because the owner may be bringing somebody else in. So for the owner and the cost of the work, they're looking at what ultimately all the things that are to build the building or to build the
the building, whatever the building or whatever the... I don't want to say project, because project is everything overall, but it's to construct the elements of what's being designed. Does that make sense? Okay. Owner's budget for the cost of the work is provided in the initial information and may be adjusted throughout the project as required under Section 5.2, 6.4, and 6.5. We'll go with 6.4 and 6.5 a little bit. We did 5.2 last week really quickly, but basically 5.2 just says, hey, if the owner wants to add more or take away more, we can do that. 6.4 and 6.5 are going to talk about how you do that. So the budget that the owner provides, owner budget, architect estimate, the budget that the owner provides can change. So just because in Article 1 in the initial information we said I've got a $10 million budget doesn't mean that won't change. There are requirements, though, throughout the project or throughout the contract that says if the budget changes, the owner must inform the architect. That's in Article 5. You have to let them know budget's going up or down because, remember, their designs are based on the umbrella or the cap of what the budget is for the owner. Preliminary estimates of the cost of work and updated estimates represent the architect's judgment as a design professional. Judgment as a design professional, not opinion or judgment as a cost estimator. So a lot of times, and as I think I told you guys last week, I'm negotiating a contract right now where the architect specifically says, we will not do any cost estimation. We will provide information to your own cost estimator, but we're not responsible for if there's a budget bust or anything else because we're just designing within our parameters. We know what your budget is. We're going to do all our internal estimates. We're not going to make any representations to you as the architect because we're not cost estimators. That's their own modification. The B101 presumes that the architect will be doing cost estimating. So it's one of the basic services, if you remember, at the end of each one of those schematic design, design development, and construction documents, the second to last paragraph says, architect will provide an estimate, and then the last paragraph says the owner will approve the estimate and go to the next phase. So the traditional basic services have the architect doing estimating to make sure we're all on track. But only as a design professional, not as a cost estimator. And the architect cannot and does not warrant or represent that the bids or negotiated prices will not vary from the owner's budget for the cost of the work or from any estimates of the cost of the work evaluation prepared or agreed to by the architect. This is kind of like the architect's get-out-of-jail-free card. And this is why a lot of architects are like, well, I don't even need to worry about this because I'm not going to do cost estimating. But if you do cost estimating and your estimates, so you've got this $10 million budget, and you tell the owner that we're at $9.6 million in my estimate, you're not guaranteeing anything. You're not warranting anything. You're doing your best as a design professional, not a cost estimator, and I'm not promising you that the bids are going to come in that way. The bids may all come in over $10 million, and they all come over $11 million. I'm not making any promises. I've done my best as an architect. So that's what this provision does. It protects you in case there is problems. But like I said, the way these contracts get drafted, there's a give and take, and so I'm going to show you a provision later in Article 6 here where the owner pulls that back a little bit. 6.3, as we already said, the architect shall be permitted to include contingencies, so maybe we're going to have an addition, maybe there's going to be price increases, maybe the price of copper is going up because of what's going on in the market. I think I used the example before when the hurricanes come in, like Hurricane Katrina, because there's so much construction that had to be done in South Florida that lumber and drywall went up to the roof because of those things. So those are contingencies that may happen. Price escalation, determine what materials. So these are some things when you're doing it, preparing your estimate. And you are allowed to make reasonable adjustments in the program and scope of the project if those things happen. All of these will roll into what your estimated cost of the work to meet the owner's budget for the cost of the work. So, again, it's to allow you guys to have some wiggle room. It's fuzzy. It's not black and white. It's not even like I always use the example of like some people that are very rigid. Some people like you describe them as they're a very black and white person. Some people that are maybe just a little bit, maybe have a little flexibility, I always call them charcoal gray because it's almost black. It's pretty dark, but it's got a little gray. This is much lighter than charcoal gray. It gives you a lot of this flexibility, but again, and that's because you're not an estimator, but again, you still have a responsibility and a fiduciary duty to the owner to design within their budget. You still want to try to do your best. You can't ignore it. Now, this one here, if you remember, we talked about last week, we talked about additional and supplemental services. There was that kind of chart, and under Article 4.1, it had that long blue chart that had all the laundry list of things with supplemental services. So this talks about if you want to do detailed cost estimating. So some design firms, larger firms, will have a whole department. Instead of them handing it off and saying, we don't do any of it, they say, we have our own department that does that. And if you want to have us do detailed cost estimating, which is going to be much more specific and much more accurate, then we will do it for you as an additional service or possibly a supplemental service so they can actually make more money off of it. So you can get more, and this allows the architects to actually generate additional revenue, which is a good thing. Point 4, the bidding and negotiation phase. So what happens is after the drawings are done in a traditional design, bid, build, and in the second half of the semester I'm going to talk about fast tracking and different ways to do it, but your traditional architecture project starts with design and the design is complete, and then you go out to bid, and then you get all the bids and you pick your contractor, and then you build. So it's a linear process and it's not overlapping. So, if the bidding or negotiation phase has not commenced within 90 days that the architect submits the construction documents, the owner's budget for the cost of the work shall be adjusted to reflect changes in the general level of the prices in the applicable construction market. So there may be times when the owner sits on drawings for 3, 6, 9, 10 months, whatever it is, because of their finances. And so if the architect designed for that budget and things have happened in the economy, tariffs up, tariffs down, whatever they might be, you know, different buildings, hurricanes, weather, who knows what happens, strikes, lots of things that could come in that could affect the market. This says my estimate of telling you that it's within your budget is really only good for about 90 days. I'm allowed to have that freedom, and the owner then has the obligation to adjust their own budget. So it's not, so the owner can't come back and say, you busted my budget. You're going, hey, you sat on these drawings for more than 90 days. So this is a protection for the architect and kind of awareness for the owner that they have to recognize these things. That's in 6.4. 6.5, if at any time the architect's estimated the cost of the work exceeds the owner's budget, so now we have that $10 million cap, and the budget, we thought it was 9.6, but if the estimate of the cost of work, maybe my estimate is at 10.2, 10.3, exceeds the owner's budget for the cost of the work, the architect shall make appropriate recommendations to the owner to adjust the project size, quality, or budget. And then the owner shall cooperate with the architect in making those adjustments. I think early on, one of the early lectures I talked about is like, I came to you, I'm the owner, and I want to have like gold-plated toilets, and I want to have 5 bedrooms and 4, 6 baths and all this other stuff, and I want you to build it for me for $1 million. Your job is to tell me, we can never do that for $1 million. So that's what this provision is saying. You have a contractual obligation after you get the program, what the contract, what the owner wants you to build or design, sorry, not build, but design. Once you get the program for the owner and you start putting it together, whether it's right off the bat because you know they're completely out of control when they say 6 bedrooms for $1 million, or whether it's you got a $10 million budget and it's coming in at 11 or 12, you, even though you're trying to be as efficient and as economical as possible, you're also trying to give the owner what they're asking for. You as the architect under 6.5 have an obligation, a contractual duty, to tell the owner, we're never going to be able to make your budget. So let's work on adjusting your scope, your project, your program. So you can't just sit back and ignore all those things. It's just, and that's the balance. Because the owner, if you think about it, the owner, they don't design. They're not out there pricing things out. They don't know what this stuff is. They're relying on you long before they even know who the contractor is. They just know they want to build this house or this factory or this store or whatever it might be. So where you'll find some owners are very sophisticated, you know, if it's like, and this is like the ultimate, but let's say you're an owner that do franchise restaurants, McDonald's over and over and over. They know how much those are going to cost. I worked for Walgreens for a number of projects. They know how much a traditional Walgreens is going to go. So this often doesn't come into play because they kind of know the markets and everything else. But when you have your kind of one-off owner, a lot of times companies only build one building. They're like, oh, it's our big capital project. We raised a lot of money. Or maybe it's for, you know, a community center or whatever those things be might be. The owners don't have that understanding. So you as the architect have to have that discussion. And this, by the way, even though it talks about in 6.5 the architect's estimate of the cost of the work, let's say that like my current contract I'm negotiating, where the architect specifically says, we are not doing cost estimating. That's fine. But 6.5 still applies, because if they're starting to do the design and they realize even an internal cost estimate is going to blow the owner's budget, 6.5 still says to the architect, you have to let them know. You can't start designing and charging them for all this work, and then they send it out to their cost estimator, and they learn from them that you were responsible in your design. So this will be effective regardless of whether you're actually taking on cost estimating formal services. Does that make sense? Okay. All right. Now, if the owner's budget for the cost of work at the conclusion of the owner's construction document phase is exceeded by the lowest bona fide bid for negotiated proposal, the owner shall. So this is this scenario where I have my $10 million budget. My architect has told me we're going to come in around 9.6 to 9.8, so we're under budget. So we're all happy, and we go out to bid. And maybe we've even taken into contingencies like the market and the availability drywall and all these other things that are going on. We've done our best. But our best, because we're design professionals, not cost estimators, or whatever's happening in the market, maybe it's really busy in the area where you want to build it. The bids come back and they're all higher. Your lowest bid is 10.7, and everything goes up all the way to 12. So we're not even close. Like, we're $700,000 over. That's like almost 7% from 10 million. So you can, with a written approval of an increase of the budget, I can go back to my board, or I can look at my own pockets if I'm building my own house or whatever, and I can say, I love your design, we're going to go with it, and I'm going to spend 11 million instead of 10 million, whatever that might be. So you can approve it, and we move merrily along. That's one. Two, authorize rebidding or negotiation of the project within a reasonable time. Let's go back out to bid and see if we can get some more aggressive bidders. So when I was building the Haribo facility, we had a whole host of contractors we wanted to use. And then it turned out that there was only so many that had time in their schedules because they were all really busy. So we went out, and there wasn't the right populace of number of bidders that we wanted. So we had to then figure out who, and we had to then expand our market so we had enough bidders. So that allowed for a rebidding or renegotiation. And that then, when you have more bidders, there's a better chance, one, that a bona fide bid will be within your budget. Or you can have negotiations back and forth, and you can bring, so like, let's say we had a 10.5 and a 10.7. Well, we don't tell the 10.7 that there's a 10.5 out there, but we say to those two, because they're the best two bids, can you sharpen your pencils? And maybe that 10.5 comes down to 10.3, or 10.7 comes down to 10.3, and then we go to the 10.5, sharpen your pencils. So you can go through that negotiation process and ultimately come up within your budget. So that's number two. Three, terminate in accordance with Section 9.5. We're done. You guys completely blew it, or I don't want to walk away for convenience. I'm out. We just aren't going to do the project. We thought that this was going to happen, but it's not. Had one of those out in New Jersey. There was a client of ours that was doing a really cool high-end medical tech center of the future. It was going to have a bunch of different suites, and each suite was going to have, like, here's how AI will change medicine and everything else. So it was a medical, I don't know if it was a medical supply company, but I can't remember exactly what they did, but it was kind of like to do education and training. And they had a budget. And they had really cool ideas of what they did. And then we hired an architect, and we had a really great relationship and everything else. And there was no way they could do what they want within the budget. So they canceled the project. And they're going to go back to the board, and they're going to figure it out. And they'll come back eventually, but you can just cancel it. Number four, in consultation with the architect, revise the project program scope or quality is required to reduce the cost of the work so you can make them revise it. Hey, go back and revise. Now, the question here, or the last one here, we have an implement any other mutual acceptable alternative. The question here on number four is, does the architect get paid for those revisions? What do you guys think? Do you think they should be paid for them? Or should they not be paid for them? Who thinks they should be paid for those revisions? About half. And the other people, who thinks they should not be paid? Nobody. Okay, so the other people don't know. That's fine. So in here, and let me make sure, I don't know if it's on the next slide, I don't know what you're saying here. Okay, so if you look back, 6.4 is what we're talking about here. You got to go back to the architect. So if you go to 6.7, it says, if the owner chooses to proceed under section 6.6.4, the architect without additional compensation shall modify the construction documents as necessary to comply with the owner's budget for the cost of the work at the conclusion of the construction document phase services, or the budget is adjusted under 6.6.1. So what happens here is, and this, remember, the AIA document requires the architect to do cost estimating. And so, again, I'm negotiating one where they negotiate it out so they can avoid this provision. But if you are obligated at the end of each phase to tell the owner, we're in your budget because here's my estimate, and it goes out to bid, and you blew the bid, you have to fix your drawings, whatever that means, reduce scope, change some of the materials, get rid of the bathroom, whatever they are. But you have to do it for free because you had this obligation to provide estimates. And all along, if your estimates were under the budget, you weren't estimating properly, or if it was over the budget, you didn't tell the owner properly for them to understand. So this sometimes can be a problem, and a lot of architects understandably don't want to do free work. So I would say, as a recommendation to you guys, try to strike this contract if you're the architect. What's going to happen is the owner's going to put it back in because they don't want to have to pay for you guys to fix your mistakes. So a compromise, which I often do this, and I'll do this on large projects. For small projects, it's not worth it for the money. Like, you just pay the architect a little bit and they'll do it, or you'll come to an agreement. But on a large project, it could be, you know, you could blow a bid by millions. I had a project where we blew the bid by like $14 million. That's a lot of redesign. So what we did is we said, so modify is necessary if they come in under 6.6.4. Sorry, if we go back one slide here. Said, or under 6.6, if it exceeds the lowest bona fide bid by 5%, 10%, 15%. So if it comes in a little over, the architect has some space. So if you're in this negotiation, this push-pull with an owner, where the owner says, if you screw up, you got to redo it for free. The architect says, but what if it's really close? I don't want to have to pay for it for free. You put this little percentage in. Okay, if I blew the budget by 10%, then I'll redo it for free. So you put 10% under 6.6. If I blew it, and the owner will come back at 5 or whatever. So you try to negotiate that number. So that's something that's not, and you won't be tested on that concept, but that's something I'm just telling you, is if you're in that situation, you want to add something in here to give you some flexibility, some float. So you don't have to be perfect. You already have provisions that kind of relieve you from that, but this also relieves you from having to do additional work for free. Question?
What is the budget loan for reducing the
architectural
diminished market value of the cost of construction? Are able to predict?
So that's a really good question. Is if the budget, if something happens between when they sign the contract and then it goes out to bid, because it could be a year, year and a half, depends on these big projects, what happens? So, up until about, I would say, 6 or 8 years ago, maybe even 10, but you would have this provision, and you would often put in the percentage kind of wiggle room. So let's say it's a 10%, so they get a $10 million, they can, anything under 11, they're good, because you get $1 million on your 10% as your buffer there. And that was normal. What's happened now more, as different things have happened, people are more cognizant of traumatic weather events that have happened. People have seen the outcomes of that. Obviously, what's gone on, up and down tariffs, yeah, no tariffs, yes tariffs, and everything else. So what are now happening is the architects, and I do the same thing for contractors, will write in a provision that is what's called an escalation clause that will take into effect these outside things. And so that may have a 10% number, but a 15% number for outside market types things. So you have to describe those. So you still have to do something to put, you can't just say, well, just because we have tariffs, then we can design whatever in the budget below, it could be anything. You still have to have some responsibilities. But I had a project that we signed the architectural agreements long before COVID, nobody knew about. But we went out to bid in the spring of 2020. And nobody knew what supply chain was, and so it took us from the spring of 2020 to like the fall of 2020, late fall of 2020, to get the contract with the architect or the contractor signed. And even over that, the price went up and up and up and up and up. Nobody knew about that stuff when we signed the contract with the architect a year and a half before. But the contract was clear. So when that bid came in, first in May or June, I don't remember what it was, of 20, it was like 16% over budget and over their estimates. We made them redesign for free. Because contractually, we were able to do that. Now, the owner was very understanding because a lot of things happened with COVID. So they ultimately paid for some of the services. They didn't pay for all of them, but they worked with them because, and that happened a lot in construction. There was a lot of owners that didn't have to eat a lot of dollars, but they did because it was happening to all of us. But we didn't, the architect still had to pay for some of the stuff. So the question of what do you do if it's completely out of the architect's hands, there is language to allow you to try to create a separate wiggle room area. And that's something, again, if you guys are ever in that position, raise that with your attorney. Like, how do I protect myself from the unknowns that are just not just market-driven, regular market stuff? So, anything else on this? Okay, that's it for cost of the work. Now, copyright and license. This is my favorite, I think this might be my favorite provision of the B101. One, I think part of it is because when I first started working as a lawyer, I don't know if I told you guys this, but the markets were crashed. I got out in 1990, so the S&Ls crashed and construction industry was gone. So I'm like, nobody wanted to hire a lawyer that had an architectural degree that wanted to do construction law because nobody was building anything. But I had my engineering degree. So I used that pitch and I went to work for a patent firm. And so I did patents and trademarks and copyrights. And I focused a lot about copyrights because obviously copyrights have effect to do with the architect's designs. And I talked a little bit about it and we'll have some more discussions on copyright. This will go throughout the semester. There also was, just coincidentally, the modification or amendment to the Architectural Copyright Act in 1990. And before 1990, if you had drawings or plans or specifications, whatever you sent into the copyright office, you got a copyright on it. The physical or the electronic version of your designs. But if somebody went out to the field, took a picture of your facade, took out a tape measure and measured your plan, and went back and took all that information and created the exact same copy of your building under the previous law, that was not copyright infringement, the way it was worked. So there was a number of cases, and this is where it came down, was in when there were a number of large-scale subdivision builders that would build a subdivision and have the Colonial and the Georgian and the Ranch, whatever the names of the styles of the houses were. And you'd go in, and they'd have like one or two models built of each house, and they're building like 90 buildings in the subdivision. And you would look through their catalog, and you're like, okay, I like the Georgian. And so which streets you want to be on, and they'd build you your house. People would take those brochures of the builders, and they'd copy it for their subdivision and do it for cheaper, and the building materials weren't as much, whatever they else. And people would see this Georgian and think that the same builder did that Georgian, only with somebody else, because they were infringing on it. Because they weren't taking the actual, or they would take photographs, they weren't taking the actual drawings that were filed with the copyright office. So those were some of the problems. So there's lawsuits about it. And so Congress came back and said, we've got to fix this for the architects. So there's the Architectural Works Copyright Act of 1990. That's right when I got out. So I ended up writing some articles on it and everything else, which is kind of cool to me because I was still very much like an architecture student, even though I graduated and went to law school. So I learned a lot about the power of what happens from it. So now, it's the embodiment of the work. So if you build a building, and somebody comes in and takes a picture of your facade, and then they build from that facade, and they take just a picture of it, that's an infringement. So it's not just what you file with the copyright office, it's actually once they build the building, that building itself is part of your copyright work. So the reason why I like this section, and depending on if I'm the owner or the architect, I modify it different ways, because it's a very, very powerful tool for you guys. This is your lifeblood. Your design is your lifeblood. And if people are going to steal your designs, they're going to pay somebody else a lot less money, and all your hard work is not going to be recognized, and somebody's going to say to you, oh, is that your Georgian? No, it's not. That crappy house is not mine. It's somebody else's. So that will affect your reputation. And if someone steals your drawings and tries to build it, then you can go back after them and get funds for it. So this section, this Article 7 of the B101, recognizes that how we, as architects, can own and hold on to these drawings and these designs, our copyright, our intellectual property, but still the building be built. So it's very powerful. The other thing is, and this is as a very hyper-technical legal concept, because it talks about here, it talks about, we'll just go here. The architect and the owner, 1171, the architect and the owner warns that in transmitting instruments of service or any other information, the transmitting party is the copyright owner of the information and has permission from the copyright owner to transmit such information for use on the project. So this is basically, this is like the only time, I think, one of the only times that you're warranting something in your contract. You're saying, I'm going to give you these instruments of service. That's a defined term that includes all the drawings and specifications and models and anything that has to do with your design process. I'm going to give these to you, to the owner, and I'm promising you that I own the copyright in this. That's the first part. Or I have permission from the copyright owner to transmit, because the architect, I'm going to do my basic services, but maybe I'm not a structural engineer, so I hire a structural engineer to prepare the structural engineering drawings. They own the copyright in that. It goes into my drawings, and so when I'm giving my drawings to the owner, I say, I promise that I own the copyrights, and the structural engineer gave me permission to also give you, and they own the copyrights in their structural work. So it's a representation, it's a warrant that, that the people that are giving this information have not stolen it from somebody else. So that's a very important thing. And I use this provision in situations where my client had their design stolen. The owner entered into an agreement with the new architect, and this provision was there. And I put to the owner, not only did they steal my drawings, so I sued the architect that stole, but I'm suing you because you and the art contractor, the architect, have representation. He said to you, he lied to you, that they owned the copyright when they didn't. So I bring them in. So I've used this provision to actually help someone that is the victim of somebody stealing their intellectual property. So that's the first kind of thing. I promise I own the copyright in this, and you can use it. 7.2, the architect and the architect's consultant shall be deemed the authors and owners of the respective instruments of service. So this is the one that says, unless anything else is known differently, this contract says we are the authors and owners of this, owner of the intellectual property. And it talks about, it includes all drawings, specification, common law, statutory, all this other stuff, blah, blah, blah. All the rest of the things that, that say what we get the protections of, because we own this, and we're representing to you, that's it. This is our stuff. And don't you take it, don't let anybody else take it, it's our stuff. So again, very protective of the architects and their livelihood. That's in 7.2. 7.3, this is the 7.3 and 7.3 one are kind of the guts of it. So, the architect grants to the owner a non-exclusive license to use the instruments of service. So a license is you allowing somebody to use your stuff. Non-exclusive says, I can give you the drawings to you, and to you, and to you, and to you. It's not exclusive for you. I can do whatever I want with these drawings because I own them. So if I'm an owner, and I've had this architect design something that's really cool and special for me, I change that non-exclusive to exclusive. I don't want people to be designing my Georgian elsewhere, or building my Georgian elsewhere. I'm a builder. I paid you to design this. I want it to be unique for us, unique for you, and unique for me and my business. So I'm going to change that to exclusive, and there's a negotiation that happens for that, but that's what it is. But for the architect, just as the basic standard language for the architect, by this lens, you can do whatever you want with those drawings. You can give it to whomever and whatever you want. So that's the first part. I'm giving you a license. Some things people don't know that are kind of interesting. So like, when you buy a computer program or an app, you don't actually own the app. You just have a license to use the app. When you buy, anybody buy vinyl anymore? You buy a vinyl record? You just get a license to use that music. You own the piece of plastic, but you really don't own the song. You can say, oh, I got this great record collection. Well, you have a great record collection of licenses. That's technically the legal part of what it is. Same thing in architecture. When they give you the drawings, and because it talks about the previous paragraph, the owners and authors, it's always going to stay owned by the architect. And here's the other technical thing that you won't be questioned on this one, but it just helps you kind of understand how it all works. Technically, let's say I'm the owner and I get a license from you. That means you're letting me use it, as it says, for the purpose of constructing, using, maintaining, altering, and adding to the project. So you can use the drawings for all of those. Even adding, in addition, I can use those for phase two. But let's say, when I give those drawings and specifications to the contractor, I don't have the license. And if the contractor is using those drawings and specifications without a license, they are technically violating the copyright. You know that the architect has given me a license. But I have to be able to give that license and transfer it to the contractor. So unless there's language that talks about that or an understanding of that, every time a contractor builds a building, they're violating copyrights. Obviously, that never happens. People want to make sure that does. And that's why we have this use for the purposes of constructing, using, and maintaining. It's effectively, and then it goes further down here, the license granted under this section permits the owner to authorize the contractor, subcontractor, etc., to use these instruments of service. So the license that says you can use it for your own self-owner, and this license is strong enough that we're going to allow you to have contractors and subcontractors do it. So this is very technical legal terms to allow the building to be built without infringement. But all of it is based on the fact that you as the architect own this. You control who does with this. So this provision will be negotiated and modified if you're an owner or an architect, stronger or weaker, everything else. But for purposes still of the AIA of 7.3, it's the architect. They get to control this, the game here. When you get down to the bottom, it says, but the owner's like, well, wait a minute. Okay, hold on a second. I get that. You own the drawings, the specifications. You've given me a license to use. That's great. I can build my building. You've given me the right to let my contractor do it, to build the building, so we're all happy and good. Oh, you defrauded me. You're cheating me. Or something happened, and I have to terminate you for cause. Because you lied to me. So I got to fire you. It's not my fault. You're a bad person. And I can't have you do this. Does that mean, though, that now you as the owner have to go back from square one? Because if you're using the drawings and you fired the architect, that license is gone because the license is attached to this contract. Now you got to hire a whole new architect. Well, if the building's halfway built, well, does he have to tear it down because the construction of it is an infringement of the copyright? So the owners are like, what happens? So this last sentence says, this is actually the owner to the architect side. Sorry about that. This is the next provision. But we'll read this one to the architect. Let me read it, and then let me explain it. It's a similar thing. So if the architect rightfully terminates this agreement for cause as provided in Section 9.4, the license granted in this section shall terminate. So this is the one where the architect says, you forgot to pay me. And the architect says, I'm done. So you, if there is a problem where the owner screwed up, my example, it's in the next section that I'll show, but if it's the other way around, the owner screwed up and the architect says, I don't want to continue to do this. You're not paying me. You're not doing this. You're not doing that. I'm going to terminate you pursuant to 9.4. I get my license back, and you can't use my drawings at all. You're not allowed. That's what this end of the sentence is. 7.3.1, it'll have the opposite. Sorry about that. The end of 731, it says, the terms of this section 731 shall not apply if the owner rightfully terminates the agreement. So this talks about here under section 9.4. So if the owner rightfully terminates, then they're not obligated. And the owner, actually, I'll add language in here that says the owner can use those drawings to complete the project. So up here, 731. If the owner uses the instruments of service without retaining the author of the instruments of service, the owner releases the architect and the architect's consultant to the claim and causes of an action arising from that use. So what does that mean? I fire the architect, but I fire him for convenience. We just aren't getting along. They didn't defraud me. They're doing their work. It's okay. It just wasn't working out. The license is going to terminate then at that time. Owner can't use the drawings. Well, maybe the architect says you can use those to finish your project, You've already paid me in full for my services, whatever it might be. Maybe the drawings are completely done, and the architect was just doing on-site work, and the owner's using it, but they terminated the agreement. For whatever reason, there's a separation between the parties. And I hire somebody else to work on the drawings. I bring in the other architect. And now the wall falls down. Or maybe I don't even hire somebody else. The wall falls down, but the architect's not there to answer questions from the contractors. They're just not around. So if I'm using those drawings and specifications, the instruments of service that you as my architect provided me, and I'm not retaining you for that process, and a cause of action, a claim or cause of action occurs, wall falls down and injures somebody, building collapses, whatever it might be, this provision says I have to indemnify and hold harmless the architect and his consultants. We talked about indemnity a couple weeks ago, but basically what that says is if someone's injured or there's property damage and I as the owner am not keeping you on board and that damage or injury occurs and you, the architect, get sued because of 731, I have to defend you. I have to pay for damages against you because I didn't keep you on. So this is a warning to the owner. If you want to use my stuff and you don't want to pay me to stay around to make sure it's properly built, and a lawsuit happens, I don't have to pay for those damages and the injuries. You do. You made the choice of getting rid of me. I'm there because I'm the expert. I'm a specialist. You've used my drawings without me helping you out. It's not my fault that the wall fell down. Maybe the design was bad, but I could have caught that had I been there. You didn't give me the opportunity. So if somebody's injured, it's $1 million damages, I don't pay it. You do, pursuant to 731. The bottom here, it says if we terminated you, if the owner terminates you properly for cause because you did defraud me, I don't have to indemnify you. So that's this one. Or, I also say, if there's a proper termination, I add, or, and I can use the drawings to complete my project. So, I don't have to have these responsibilities of paying you if you were the bad actor. You the architect were the bad actor. Does that make sense? How the kind of shifting of responsibilities work? Okay. And then 7.4, separate license granted in this section, no other license rights shall be deemed granted. Any authorized use of the instruments of service shall be the owner's sole risk and without liability to the architect and the architect's consultant. This is like, I'm only giving you these drawings and these licenses. I'm not giving you anything else. That's it. I'm not giving you anything else. It's just what we have limited here. And if you're using it without me, authorized, unauthorized, whatever it might be, it's completely at your risk. So this provision, this Article 7, is all about protecting the architect. It's all about protecting your livelihood, your business, your reputation, and how you make money, as well as making sure that you're not caught on a lawsuit where you're not involved and you never have the opportunity to correct what you may have done defectively or to help the owner so something doesn't go wrong. That's why I like this so much for the architect. Like this, I think this is one of the strongest provisions in the agreement that you use. And when I'm representing an owner, I have like so many edits to this, but I also try to make it clear. Like one of the things that I do with my negotiations is I'm like, I really want to do a proper risk balancing. So what I'll say in this provision, just and again, this won't be on the test, but this is an example. What I'll say to the, I'm an owner and I want to spec a really special design. What I'll say to the architect is, like, you still own your drawings, but it's exclusive, it's only for me. And they're like, well, wait a minute, there's going to be windows and door details in here that I use on every single drawing. So my provision says, except for common uses of your designs, you can keep those and I don't have any right over those. And then, if there is going to be the situation where I'm using somebody else for phase two, I had a project like this where we had the architect design us phase one, it was going to be a tower, and two and three were going to be two more towers, condo buildings. We only ended up building phase two, we didn't do phase three, but we did phase two. We went with another architect. There was a whole bunch of other issues. It wasn't because we didn't like the architect. We paid, though, we had negotiated into the agreement that the architect for phase one, even though we're using a different architect for phase two, we're using the architect's same drawings from phase one, phase two, literally like a cookie cutter. We still paid a license fee to the architect. So the architect in phase one, did no work on phase two, but they got a fairly substantial, it was a high six-figure fee so we could use their drawings, and we indemnified them, and we protected them. So if this architect that we hired screwed up, we would protect the first guy. So there's ways you can draft to give the owner more flexibility from what's in here, but still protect the architect. And that's what I like to do. Like, I don't think the architect ever should be left out in the cold, even if I'm representing the owner. It's just not right. So, okay, questions on Article 7. Article 8, claims and disputes. So claims and disputes are if something goes wrong. Now we're in this position where, like, oh my God, something went wrong. What do we do? How do we handle it? And a good contract will tell you what to do. I just did another contract with teams, really short-form contract. The owner wanted something quick, done, dirty, very short, and they got this contract, which wasn't bad. It was very short. I have a feeling, I'm not positive, I have a feeling it was drafted by AI because there were certain like sentences that just kind of stopped, and there was a couple sentences that didn't make any sense, and I'm like, but it had a lot of your normal traditional language that I see over and over and over. So I could see this AI pulling like this type of provision, this like plug, plug, plug. But there were some weird provisions. It could have been maybe the drafter, it could have been by somebody normal in the drafter just didn't know what they're doing, but there was some stuff there. There was one whole section missing entirely though. It was what happens if something goes wrong? What happens if there's a claim? How do the parties resolve that? So I stuck that in and then we moved merrily along after I corrected some of the other weird stuff. But you need to have a process because 99% of your projects are all going to be good and happy and everybody's good, blah, blah, blah. But there are going to be times when stuff comes up. Or maybe even in a project where it's moving along really well and there's an owner, the owner says, well, I thought you were going to design this in. And you're like, I did. And the owner's like, but you didn't. So even though everything's okay, there's still this kind of, what was the responsibilities? What were the roles? How do we handle that? Okay. 811. The owner of the architect shall commence all actions and cause of actions, whether in contract, tort, or otherwise. So it's not just contracts, even though you have a contract, there may be a tort or otherwise. Blah, 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 blah. Within the period specified by the applicable law, but in any case not more than 10 years after the date of substantial completion, owner and architect shall waive all claims and cause of actions not commence within accordance with section 811. So this is a timing provision. This provision, the very first provision, is if you have some beef between each other, you have to do it within the time specified here. So the first one says, by the applicable law, each state is going to have, remember we talked about the statute of limitations. And remember in Illinois we have this 4 years of statute of limitations for when they knew or should have known. But if they only should have known on day 365 of the third year, or 364 of the third year, or maybe it was later, you could have 4 years more. Like, it's all about, there's that 10-year statute of repose. You remember that? We talked about that. You could discover anything in Illinois within the first 10 years after the project's completed, and then you have another 4 years after it. So in Illinois, it could be up to 14 years. Illinois, Washington, there's a couple other states that are like that. If you're in Minnesota, I believe Wisconsin, but I know for sure Minnesota, it's just 6 years no matter what. Whether you discovered it or not discovered it, you get 6 years. All of those from state to state to state is the applicable law that you have to file suit within that period. So that's the first thing. And then it goes on and says, but in any case, not more than 10 years after the date of substantial completion. So when you're in a contract with Illinois, this is often stricken because this could be up to 14. So we say applicable law because Illinois gives you more. The owner will want to keep that. The architect wants it 10 years. So first provision of how you handle claims dispute, you got to file it on time. That's what 811 is.
Which one would apply?
10 years because the applicable law. Well, actually, let me go back. I don't know if it has been several shorter. Yeah, but in any case, not more than 10 years. So in Illinois, you could be up to 14, but this gives an ultimatum. Applicable law, but never more than 10 years, so it puts a cap on it. Sometimes it'll say, period specified the application, or 10 years after the date of substantial completion, whichever comes earlier. Sometimes you'll see whichever comes earlier, but this says no more than. So there's a narrowing or limiting. Great question. 812 talks about insurance, and it refers to the H01 and how the insurance stuff works on that. we're not going to talk. We already did one section on insurance. When we get to the H1, I'm going to talk a little bit more about insurance, but no need to worry about it here in this part. 813. The architect and the owner waive consequential damages for claims, disputes, or other matters in question arising out of or relating to this agreement. What does that mean? So, remember we had the discussion on damages. There's like expectation damages, there's reliance damages, there's all these different types of damages, and I want you to, part of, even though I may have a damage question in 6, but go back and look at damages, because there's going to be some questions about what type of damages. You'll read a paragraph and it'll say what type of damages is the best, or what type of damages are being discussed here, whether that's going to relate to these, another element of how they're going to work. Here we have this thing called consequential damages. Consequential damages, and I don't remember exactly, but I'm like 99.9% confident there's a slide in there on consequential damages, but I'll remind you again. Consequential damages is a damage that's not directly related to the work or the services. So, if I'm going to, like one of the cases I worked on early in my career, I'm supposed to have a casino in New Orleans that's supposed to open on September 1st. And I know that I make $1 million a day as the owner from slot machines. So if I don't open on September 1st, every day I'm losing $1 million on the generation of my business. That's a consequence of the building opening late, and it has nothing to do with something wrong with the building. So consequential damages are lost profits, are salaries, are things that are removed. Direct damages are, how much does it cost to put a new light bulb? How much does it cost to fix the wall that fell down? What's the cost of keeping contractors on the project site for longer? So if that project, what's going to happen is, the project doesn't open on September 1, not only am I going to lose $1 million in revenue, but I have to pay for every other contractor and subcontractor that's on the project site waiting around to do their work. So my damages are even higher, but I can only recover paying for the trades and paying for the work and those types of things, insurance that relates specifically to the project, not to my business. Same with the architect. Let's say we have an architect that has like a really good, brisk business, and you hire them as the owner hires them, and they're like, I want the A-team. You're like, well, my A-team is like, you got to pay top dollar for them because I use them over and over and over. Like, that's cool, I'll pay for you. And we put together a schedule, and we know that the project's supposed to be finished, and the architect's A-team can go to the next project starting on February 1st. Well, the owner lollygags, doesn't do their stuff, the contractor's delayed, blah, 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 all this other stuff, and February 1st comes and goes, and March 1st comes and goes, and now we're into April. The A-team still has to be on the project. But the owner now, or the architect, has now lost 3 other really cool bids because they can't bring the A-team. And they could have made even more profit on those. But the consequential damage, the architect can't say, I lost money on other jobs, because both sides have waived consequential damages. They can charge for the architect the A-team's time in February, March, April, May, whatever it is, because that's direct. But they cannot charge for losing another job. They cannot lose for lost profits, those kinds of things. So this provision, and the reason I'm going over this is I know I said this before, this provision, never be in a construction contract without this provision being in here. You must always have a waiver of consequential damages, because if you don't, that owner is going to hit you for $1 million a day because they didn't waive it. It needs to be in there. It's less important. The owner's always going to ask for your waiver, but you guys aren't. It's like 85 to 90% where the owner's going to have a lot more leverage and dollars against you in actual or direct damages. So you want to make sure the owner waives consequential damages. This is an important provision you always have in here. It's not that I've never done a construction contract. I've seen construction contracts that don't have it, and I always put it in. And it doesn't matter if I'm representing an owner, a contractor, an architect, an engineer, anybody. This provision is one of the most important ones you have to have into all your construction agreements, because keep it just to the project. Okay? Mediation. We talked about the three, way back early on, we talked about mediation and arbitration and different ways to solve things. So the provision, the contract here says, any claim, dispute, or other matter or question arising out of a relationship agreement shall be subject to mediation. So we got to do mediation. And then they have to proceed in accordance with applicable law and comply with lien filing notices and everything else. So it talks about what you have to do. But the first step, if there's this dispute, or the first formal step, is mediation between the owner and the artist. 822, they shall endeavor to resolve claims and disputes and other matters and questions between them by mediation. Talks about you got to use these type of rules and everything else. And the mediation shall proceed in advance of binding dispute resolution proceedings. So you have to do mediation first before you go to arbitration or litigation. Now, because these are all contract terms, you can agree to do them simultaneously, you can change these around, but as according to the AIA, mediation and then binding, which binding is either arbitration is binding or traditional litigation and courts binding. So you have to do this first. It also says, shall endeavor to resolve. Mediation, you're not forced to do it. Remember, mediation is non-binding. So you guys could spend a day, 2, 5 days. I've had 3 or 4 day mediations where we're back and forth, multiple parties, and it doesn't resolve. Because we can't come to an agreement. The mediator did their best, but the parties are too far apart. They hated each other from the last movie, whatever it is, the reason. So you do your best. You endeavor to resolve claims. So there's no mandatory resolution because mediation is non-binding. And then if they don't resolve the dispute through mediation, pursuant to 8.2, the section, the method of binding resolution shall be as follows. So now, prior to 2007, so the 97s and 87s, I believe it was 97s, but I know for sure the 87s, it was mediation, arbitration. You had to, by their contracts, pick arbitration. Now, arbitration was brought in, I think, in the 50s or maybe even earlier, as a faster, quicker, cheaper solution to litigation. Oh, litigation is so much paperwork, and it's bogged down by the court systems and everything else. So people started, like, let's do it faster, better, cheaper. And the judge they don't know anything about construction. So with arbitration, we hire people that are construction lawyers or are contractors, or they have understanding of the industry. So it was this really good system that was put together, and it made sense. So for many years, mediation, arbitration, that's what the AIA required. Boris screwed it all up. We made arbitration as long or longer or worse than court. And the lawyers that became arbitrators took advantage of the loopholes in arbitration because the arbitration was written to say you don't have to be a lawyer, but there's a lot of lawyers that take advantage of it. I'm not a big fan of arbitration. I do arbitration when the clients are private, when there's things you don't want to have in the public world, but most of the time I want to do litigation. And in 07, and obviously along with the 17s, the AIA recognized we can't say you should only do arbitration because arbitration no longer became faster, better, cheaper. Sometimes it is. But often it wasn't. Sometimes it was worse. And so here, you got to check the box. We all have to mediate, but if we can't do it through mediation, what are we going to do? Well, let's do arbitration. If we can't do it through mediation, let's do litigation. Or let's do something else. And there's some other types of need arb. There's also these different type of guided choice and things like that. You don't have to worry about it. Your lawyer will know about those other options. But this allows the parties, when they're negotiating the contract, to say, mediation followed by arbitration or followed by litigation. So, my preference when I'm using a normal, not normal, when I'm working with a large scale client or a regular client that's not high profile or has confidential issues that may be in the project, I do mediation litigation because you can control the court systems. You may remember when we talked about arbitration, there's no appeal process. Of course, you can appeal. So if the arbitration panel screws up, you're stuck. If the judge screws up or the jury screws up, you can try to appeal and see what happens. So I always like kind of more protections from the court systems. That's my personal preference. If it's a general, normal client, arbitration, or mediation, litigation. If it's a private client, because I represent a number of high net worth people, they don't want their names in the public. You know, when you build a house for, like I've had in my career, luckily, knock on wood,
I've had a half a dozen projects where they're residential projects, $50 million or above. So that's one person building a $50 million series of projects, of estates, or maybe one house. And they're cool, really cool projects. Those people don't want to be in the press. They don't want to have. So I do mediation, arbitration, because arbitration is private. Sometimes, like, I work for not-for-profits, and their donor backing system of people who donate, or foundations, will do arbitration with them. So there are certain types of businesses where I will ask them, because I know, do you guys want to be in court, or do you want to be in private? And they'll say private. So we'll do arbitration. It's not my favorite, and I'll explain to them the pluses and minuses. But 9 times out of 10, people that have reasons to be not in the court system just because their private lives or they're more of a public person, so they want to be private, will still do arbitration because it's more protective of them. But you still get to choose either one. And then if you choose arbitration, it's nice because now they have this set of rules of how you do arbitration. So if they selected arbitration, they shall be selected subject to a mutually agreed otherwise administered by the American Arbitration Association in accordance with their construction industry rules. So there's a group out there called the American Arbitration Association, the AAA. They have all these rules of how to do their process. And if you choose arbitration, the AIA says, we think the AA, the American Arbitration Association, has got the best set of rules, so you can follow us. You can change. There's an organization out there called JAMS. You can change American Arbitration Association to JAMS. You can change who your parties are, the entity that you're arbitrating under, and their rules. But this is the standard, normally, what happens here. I was at a presentation yesterday, which I was... They've only had a couple, and they actually haven't gone to completion. But for small cases, the American Arbitration is now doing an AI arbitration. There's going to be a person there that's truly your arbitrator, but what ends up happening is you feed all your information in, and then the AI tells you who's going to win. And I'm like, God, I'm not sure if I'm ready for that. Like, and then they say they have this, they have an option where you can just run it through AI privately so you can pay for their service. So you're doing the normal arbitration process, but you can plug all that information into the private AI and they tell you whether you're going to win or lose, and the AI is going to tell you that. The other side doesn't know anything about it. So that may be a tool better to learn, but I was like, I'm not sure if I'm ready for an AI to tell me whether I'm going to win or lose my case. And so they only have, like the person that was giving the presentation, I said there's only a few that have, because it's just started, that are working through the system. So they have no feedback yet and everything else. But it's just, like I said, I'm not ready for that. I don't trust them yet. So, okay, 832-8311. The demand for arbitration shall be made no earlier than the concurrently with the filing of the request for mediation. Basically, that says, remember, it says you've got to do mediation first before we arbitrate, but you are allowed to file and ask for both at the same time. And sometimes you do that because you're like, I think that we're so far apart, the mediation's not going to be successful, but I have to do it, so let's just get it going and we'll start the arbitration right away. Or, I want them to know I'm serious, so that's why I'm filing them both at the same time. And I often will do that with my clients. I don't want to wait till the mediation doesn't occur or we're dragged out before I actually have the arbitration on file and ready to go, because then you can hit the ground running. This allows you to do both, filing both at the same time, but you still got to go through the mediation first. 832. So what happens if, once you have the arbitration ruling, architect wins, they were not paid enough, they owed $1.6 million. So the architect has this piece of paper from three construction lawyers that says the architect's owed $1.6 million. What do I do with this? How do I collect it? The arbitrators, they had power over us, but nobody else. How do I enforce that? Well, this provision, 832, says, shall be specifically enforceable in accordance with the applicable law in any court. So you take that $1.6 million judgment, you walk over to your courthouse, you file a judgment action, and then the court can enforce it, meaning they can send out sheriffs, they can citations of people's assets. So you use the normal court system if the other side's not paying you to collect that $1.6 million. So it's a protection that says,
We know you used this private process. We know you didn't want your, you thought it was going to be better, quicker, faster, cheaper, whatever the reasons why you did arbitration. You got a decision, but we still have to use the courts to make sure you're paid. Sometimes you don't need to do this. Like, I had a case where we were owed money, and they were dancing around and not paying my client. And about 2 months in, I wrote them a letter, and I'm like, I'm going to A3-2 you, write me my check, or I'm going to take you to court, and then you're going to have to spend more legal fees. You already lost. Do you want to spend more money? And then they paid us. So a lot of times you can use it as a threat, but I've also had to pay. I've also had to file this to get the money paid to. So it's a protection for the winner. Or a loser. The loser's like, look, I don't have to pay that. I mean, I lost, but I only have to pay this much. It's not more. So, the award rendered by the arbitrator shall be final. Remember, it's binding. So you can't appeal. You can't go any further. It's final. That's it. We all agree to this process. You're stuck with it. There are some limited exceptions, and I think I may have brought those up before, fraud or otherwise, but by and large, arbitration is final. A3-4. So remember, this agreement is only between architect and owner. So the only people that have to go, let's say you chose mediation arbitration, the only people that are required to go to mediation arbitration is the architect and owner, because contractually, those are the only people who sign the agreement. Well, there's a contractor and a subcontractor and an electrical engineer and all the other people on the project. A3-4 takes that into consideration. It says either party, at its sole discretion, may consolidate an arbitration with any other arbitration so that we can join. I have an arbitration going on with a contractor about the wall falling down, but I think the architect designed it wrong. We have two arbitrations. We can consolidate those. We can bring them together. So long as the agreements allow consolidation, so I want this provision in with my contractor as well. We have to have a mirrored provision. If substantially involved common questions of law or fact, the wall fell down, the wall fell down. Not the wall fell down and the windows were leaking. Those aren't necessarily going to be combined. And the arbitrators employ a similar procedural rules. Provision contractor, a contractor's agreement says we use JAMS rules. Architect's contract says we use American arbitration rules. Can't consolidate those. The good thing is with the AIA contracts is they use mirror language over and over and over. You don't have to think about it. But if you're using off-book forms or stuff like that, make sure that everybody's doing consolidation. Make sure everybody has the same rules, whatever those might be. But the AIA helps you out with that, which is nice. Questions on that? And then 8342, a joinder provision. So consolidation is when you have two separate arbitrations going. We can consolidate it. Sometimes you can consolidate mediations as well. Joinder means you can join someone in. I sued you as the architect, and we're in arbitration. You said it's not my fault, it's my electrical engineer, but as the owner, I can't bring in the electrical engineer. I only have a contract with you, the architect. You can bring in the electrical engineer and join them to our arbitration. This provision allows you, as long as your contract with your electrical engineer says the same thing. So we all have to have the same stuff. And not surprisingly, the AI has forms between architects and consultants and contractors and subcontractors, and they use all the same language. So again, it helps take care of you. But if you're, again, off-book, make sure you have these same things and that all flows downstream. And one of the things that will happen, it's not in this, but we'll talk about it in the A201. As the owner, I say to the contractor, I want to see a sample of your subcontract to make sure that my stuff is in that contract and it's flowed downstream. You want to protect yourself that way. Any questions on claims and disputes? Yes?
I'm struggling to understand how 8.3.4.2 is different from 8.1. Like, what is the difference between a joinder and
consolidation? Consolidation means I file for arbitration against the contractor, and that's proceeding.
And then later I found out that the architect really screwed up the design, so I filed a separate arbitration with them. So I have two things separate. I consolidate them. I bring them together. Joinder is, I sue the contractor, I have the contractor in an arbitration, I find out that the architect, instead of filing a separate one, I join the architect into the one that's already pending, or the contractor wants to bring in their electrical subcontractor or their mechanic or their plumber or whatever, the contractor can join them in as well. So it's one thing that already exists and you're bringing them together as opposed to two things that exist and you're consolidating them together. It's just the mechanics. The ultimate goal for both of those provisions is, hey, we can all be at the same dance. So, but that's a really good question. It's literally just a mechanics difference of how you process you bring in somebody by joining them with what's already existing or consolidating them and bringing them across. So sometimes what will happen is, the answer to your question, is there any pros and cons? There's not any pros and cons because it is based on the facts and scenarios of what happened. You may have a scenario where, I've had this scenario once, where there was a mediation between the owner and the contractor. The mediation was unsuccessful. And during the course of the time, the owner found some more stuff out about, they didn't like the architect and they had some issues with that. They also didn't like their lawyer. So they went to a new lawyer, and the new lawyer filed a separate mediation against the architect. And it was with separate mediators than the owner had with the contractor. We got brought in by Joinder under the contractor because we were a subcontractor. So we're in the first one that was filed because the mediation was unsuccessful. That started arbitration. And that contractor brought us into that one. So we're here with the contractor and a bunch of subcontractors. So there's like 10 or 12 of us sitting over here because that had been pending for like a year. But when there was a new process and a new lawyer brought in, there was a separate thing here with the owner and the architect because the new lawyer didn't do a Joinder. They brought in the architect over here. So then we, even though we were way down at the bottom, we were joined in. We were the only ones that were like, this is stupid. We're all in different forums. We don't have a decision that's for us here and against us here or whatever. The different courts or different forums. So we filed a motion with our arbitrators to consolidate the two together. And then it happened. So it's not one better than the other. It's just how you get everybody to the dance. And it's a process to allow you to do that. So, any other questions on that? Okay. Termination or suspension. So now we're in a process where the marriage is really rocky. We're either going to have a divorce, or we're going to have a cooling off period. We've got to figure it out. Or maybe the marriage was happy and fine and I lost my job or whatever I needed. I need more money. I got to get more financing. Sometimes you suspend a project because of financing. You just have to hold. So what do we do and how do we deal with that? Like, so we have now some contractual terms of how you terminate, what happens, how do you get paid, who can terminate how. So that's what we're going to talk about here, or suspending. So, 9.1. If the owner fails to make payments to the architect in accordance with the agreement, such failure shall be considered substantial non-performance and cause for termination, or that the architect's option cause for suspension of performance under this agreement. So if you're not getting paid, you can either say, I'm done, I'm walking away, and I'm terminating you, that's it, gone. Or you can say, I'll give you a break, but I'm going to suspend my work, and if I have costs during suspension, meaning I have to keep my A team, but they're not working in other projects, so we have to pay for them there. That's a direct damage because of that. It's not a consequential because you've lost another job. We're having them still on your project, but we still have to pay them. I can get compensation for that. So we can, as the architect, if you're not getting paid, for sure the AIA says terminate or suspend. It's your choice as the architect. And then it says, if it's a suspension, before resuming services, the architect shall be paid all sums due, prior to the suspension, and any expenses occurred in the interruption and the resumption of the architect services. So all the 18 just sitting around on their heels, that's an interruption cost. So the owner, before I start up, you got to pay me all the stuff that hasn't paid me, plus my time that I'm just sitting around waiting for you to get your stuff together. The architect's fees to remain services in the time scheduled shall be equitably adjusted. Oh, and by the way, because you suspended the project for 6 months, or whatever the time might be, our rates went up. Because remember I told you, our rates go up on January 1st every year. So now the project's going to be a little more expensive. Oh, and by the way, the schedule has to be extended. So you have to give me some breaks. I don't still have to have my schedule because you slowed me down. So these are some protections for the architect. If the owner causes something and doesn't pay. 9.2. If the owner suspends the project, so I suspend, I'm saying stop because I got to get financing or whatever it might be, the architect shall be compensated for services performed prior to the notice of start of suspension. So as soon as I send you that letter that says put all pencils down, you send me a bill and say, here's my bill through all pencils down, pay me at least through here. It may be at like the 15th of the month, and you normally don't send the bill to the 30th of the month, or whatever it might be. But you get paid all the way to the day that I send you that letter that says pencils down. And then when the project resumes, should be compensated, etc., for the interruption and resumption. The other fees for remaining service at the time shall be equitably adjusted. So this is when the owner creates a suspension. The first paragraph that we had on the previous screen was when the owner didn't pay and the architect starts a suspension. But in either situation, if it's a suspension, before the architect has to start working again, they have to be made whole. Expectation damages. 9.3. If the owner suspends a project for more than 90 cumulative days, not consecutive, cumulative. So maybe there's like a break here, a break here, a break here over the long project. 90 cumulative days for reasons other than the fault of the architect. The owner has money, doesn't have money, whatever the might be. The architect may terminate. So that's the second reason under the AIA that the architect can terminate. One, you didn't pay me. Two, at least 90 days total, you made me sit around and do nothing. You may pay me for all those times that I'm sitting around doing nothing, but I have better things to do with my A-team, and you are hindering my business going out and getting other things. I know I can't get those consequential damages, so because you are interrupting the flow of my business, I can terminate and walk away. And I didn't do it for wrong because this is I'm allowed to terminate. So this is termination for cause. Question back there.
Could you use that to say, alright, we're too far, I don't want to terminate this project, but I'm taking the 18 and putting it elsewhere?
Let me see if I understand the question. So, project suspended, not suspended, now we're at 90-day suspension.
Yeah.
And you come back to the owner and you're like, you're killing me, I've lost all these jobs and I can't get the money for all the jobs I lost, but I'm going to revise my, and I'm going to take the 18 away.
Yeah.
Can you use that technically because your remedy, if they say no, is okay, then I terminate because this provision allows me to terminate. So you can use that as a leverage, as the hammer. How the marriage is after you use that for a hammer going forward, maybe not the best. So there's businesses, things that come into those decisions. Yes, you can use that. Because elsewhere in this provision, in this contract, it talks about, I don't think it does. I add a provision in called key personnel into every contract I do that says, if you give me the A-team, they have to be the A-team, and you can't let them leave unless you ask me permission. So as an owner, I do that. But that's not in the standard AIA. So, again, you can do that. It's what will be the fallout from that relationship. But yes, you could. You would just have to see how it went. You know, maybe you only need the senior person of the A-team, and the rest of the team goes together. Maybe you can work it out with the owner, and you have those discussions. There's ways I would recommend, and you can use that as kind of like a carrot stick. But to keep the relationship good and maybe for the next project or the next referral, you don't just drop that in the first letter. But technically, you can use that if you need. So, because it allows you to terminate. You always have that hammer. Now, because I represent a lot of owners, I always strike this. When I'm an owner, the only time an architect can terminate and the only time a contractor can terminate is if they're not paid. The reason being is because they always have the right to suspend if I'm doing things wrong and I'm screwing up or I don't have my money, the architect can suspend and they are always going to be made whole. They're going to be paid for the work they did to a certain point plus all the time sitting around. So my philosophy as the owner's representative, when I represent owners, is monetarily you're never going to be hurt. We're going to take care of you. So you can only terminate if I didn't pay you and you asked me to pay and I still said no. Then you can terminate me. But you're right, back there in your question is you're going to say, well, I am getting hurt monetarily because I'm losing other jobs. So there's that balancing factor. But the AIA says you can terminate. You get two at least here. Not paying and too much suspension. That's the architect. Either party may terminate this agreement upon not less than 7 days written notice should the other party fail substantially to perform in accordance with the terms of this agreement through no fault. That's kind of like not just payment, but maybe me as the owner, remember I'm supposed to give you information about the property and I'm supposed to respond to RFIs and I have my obligations in Article 5. Maybe I'm not doing that and that's hurting you and slowing down your process and you're worried about delays or whatever they may be. Maybe I'm saying you have to give me 5 bedrooms for $1 million and I'm not being reasonable. Those are potential breaches of my violations. I've breached the contract, and so 9.4 says you could also terminate me, not just for payment and not just for suspension, but you can terminate me, the owner, if I violated, I think it's substantially to perform, I substantially violated a portion of the contract. It's not just one time that I was delayed in giving you a return on an RFI, if I'm substantially violating the contract. So there's three ways now that you can terminate as an architect. The owner can do the same thing because it's either party. 9.4 allows either party to terminate for cause. Cause means the other side has substantially failed to perform or breached. Okay? 9.4, both parties can terminate for cause. 9.5, the owner, this is only the owner, to terminate this agreement not less than 7 days written notice for convenience and without cause. I don't like the color of the tie you wore yesterday. You're fired. It's as simple as that. For my convenience, I can terminate an architect. Now, it'd be stupid because the owner has to get a new architect, they've lost their license, blah, 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 because those provisions I showed you earlier in the termination section kept referring to only 9.4, termination for cause. If I terminate for convenience just because I don't like the color of your tie, or maybe what you've done is close to a breach, but not quite. We keep fighting, but the marriage is not completely over, so I'm just going to walk away. We're going to terminate you for convenience. Only the owner is allowed to do that. The architect can't just say, I don't like you, I want to terminate for convenience. I have an architect right now who is like way, way up there. Super, superstar architect. That architect wants to terminate for convenience in the project, in their contract. I'm like, I can't give this to an architect. Like, how? If they walk away, like my owner, and my owner's way up there too. Like, they're both big, 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 high known. And I'm talking to the owner's rep about it yesterday, and we're like, we may have to give this architect the termination for convenience because we really want them to do this work. Like, we want them. And so it's who wants more. But it's the only time, I don't think I've ever had an architect asking for termination for years. I think it's the first time in like 30 years. So, but it's like, the owner really wants them. So, you know, you're kind of balancing that because they can just walk away because they don't like you. That's what this is. I don't like you. I don't like your tie. I'm walking away. Now, if you're terminating for convenience, again, there's all these payments that you're entitled to and everything else. So it's not like the architect is going to get hurt. And there may be sometimes even a provision that allows you to get lost profits because it's terminating for convenience. Depends on what the contract says. Question back there. Okay, great question. Why should only the owner be allowed to terminate for convenience? So when the contract, if you go back to Article 7, which talks about who owns the copyright and the license to the documents, unless the owner has terminated the architect for cause under 9.4, as soon as the agreement is terminated, the license reverts back to the architect. So we're halfway through the project. It's under construction. And the architect's like, God, that coffee you gave me this morning was terrible. I'm out. I've been tired of drinking your bad coffee all the time. I'm terminating you. Now, the owner's sitting there. The license is gone. And anything the owner does forward is a breach of their copyright. So the architect can stop the project. The owner can't build the project. and the owner has to start from the beginning. So the damages that the owner faces that is not recoverable, because the architect just says, I'm gone and I'm taking my license with me, I'm not playing your sandbox anymore. The owner has many more financial risks and damages that they can't recover. They have to hire a new architect, they have to start a new project, everything has to start from the beginning. Whereas the architect should just move on. If the owner terminates an architect for convenience, the architect gets paid for the work they've done to date, so they're not out of pocket for what they've done. There may be a lost profit, maybe that they were going to make X number of profits going forward, depending on how that's negotiated. And then that architect can go out and get their next job, but they aren't stuck with having to, with a building that's half building that you can't finish. So the risks and the balances are so much different. Same with a contractor as well. If a contractor is able to terminate for convenience when the project's halfway done, while there's not the copyright stuff, the owner still has to bring somebody in and a new contractor to finish that project. It's always going to cost the owner double, triple, even more to finish. So it's just so much more cost. And then the final really simple one is, I'm the owner, I have the money, I'm paying you so I can make that term. That's like the simplest is I get to make the terms, because if you don't like that term, I'll go somewhere else. But that's basically, it's a financial issue between why they only have the owner can be termination for convenience. So. And then, so if it's termination, it's no fault of the architect, they're compensated for services performed with reimbursable expenses, et cetera, et cetera. They can sometimes have, like I said, whatever their cost that they're out of. Termination expenses are in addition to compensation. Sometimes you may define, hey, I get, if you terminate me, like I have a clause right now that says if you terminate me for convenience, you owe me termination expenses equal to 10% of the original contract value. So let's say it's a $600,000 architectural agreement. We've paid you $590,000 and then we terminate for convenience because we don't need you for the last $10,000. I mean, stupid, but let's say that happens. I still have to pay the architect $60,000, 10% of the $600,000 thing, to walk away. It's a walk away fee. It's a buyout fee, effectively. So, and then any other expenses which the architect has to terminate, maybe they have their own cost downstream, maybe they rented a trailer to be on the project site and that trailer's lease is going to go for another 3 months and they have to pay those. All those types of expenses the owner has to pick up when they terminate for convenience. And it's so that the architect, for reliance damages, they relied on being on that contract for the whole time, doesn't get hurt. You left early, but I relied on you to finish, so I have all these costs. Give me my reliance damages. Okay? That's it on the damages. Any questions on that in termination? All right. Miscellaneous. We're almost done. This is going to kind of fly through. The agreement governed by laws of the state where the project is. So if you're building a project in Florida, it's laws of Florida, whatever it is, that's pretty common. Although I have had a project, I had a project in Michigan where it was governed by the laws of Texas. That was a nightmare. But I didn't sign the contract. It was signed by, it was one of those really cool high-end upscale log cabin homes. It's like a $3 million log cabin home. And the company that supplied all the logs was out of Texas. And then they had a builder that was out of Ohio, and the building was built in Michigan. So we had three different states that were involved in it. And the contractor was so bad, like it was terrible. The couple that built it was, the man had been in a very bad accident, and so he was a paraplegic. And so he had a significant recovery and used that money to build a house for he and his wife. And it was all accessible, handicap accessibility and everything else. But it was in Michigan, so when the winters were cold, you could hold a candle by the windows and the wind would blow it out from the inside because they didn't seal it and it was terrible. But all the law that we had to use was Texas law because the company that supplied all the laws was had it in the contract. And this guy that signed the contract, he didn't use a lawyer, it was just an average Joe that had money and he trusted them and ended up getting screwed because the house was a mess. And so we represented him and we were in court in Michigan with Texas law. So normally though, under the contract, if they use an AIA, it would have been the law where the project is located. And then the party also has selected whatever form is, AAA or mediation or whatever. Then two, the terms of the agreement shall have the same meaning as those in the A201 general conditions of the contract for construction. This is this concept of there's going to be rinse repeat, everything over and over. We're going to have the same terms. So if you have if you see a defined term in this document, it's going to be the same definition in the AIA A201 and all of them. All the definitions in all the AIA documents are the same, which is great. 10.3, the early architects respectively bind their agent successors and assigns as legal representatives. Neither the owner nor the architect shall sign the agreement without written consent. Who's basically saying is, hey, if I have a subsidiary, we all have to follow the same rules. We're all bound under this agreement. And before I sign this contract, if I sign it as the principal or the parent company, and I sign it to my subsidiary company, or in the case that I had with my owner and he is supposed to assign it to his daughter, remember that strip mall project I talked about? You have to tell the other side. You have to have written consent. And that was one of the things that we fought on, is that there was an assignment in that strip mall case where the owner assigned it to his daughter but didn't get our consent. So that was one of the things we fought on, that the assignment was not legitimate. 10.4, we don't need to worry about. 10.5, nothing contained in this agreement shall create a contractual relationship with or a cause of action in favor of a third party against either the owner or the architect. What does that mean? What that means is this is a contract just between us, owner and architect only. You're like, well, why do we need to say that? Like, of course it's a contract, because at the last page it says signature owner, signature architect. First page, this agreement is between the owner and architect. Why do we have to say this? Well, somewhere along the line there was litigation, because in half a dozen weeks you're going to see in the A201 there's this whole section, Article 4, that's all about what the architect does and what's expected of the architect. So maybe the contractor's like, well, I can use this contract because it's the same stuff. No, you can't. It's only between the owner and the architect. Or somebody's injured on the project and they're a third party. Oh, I can use the legal obligations between the owner and architect because I'm a third party and they breached that obligation up here. No, it's the terms and conditions in the owner-architect agreement are only the owner and architect. Nobody else can play in that sandbox. And like I said, there's obviously litigation about it because they had to stick it in. It's a simple provision. It's a simple contractual idea, but they put it in. 10.6, no responsibility for the presence of family, legal, disposal, express. Oh, 10.6 just says, it's talking about hazardous materials. That's why impacted substances. You as the architect, when you're designing a standard of care, really shouldn't be designing with toxic substances. You shouldn't be putting things into the design that are toxic and hazardous. That's your job as a standard of care in your design. But if something's already on the property, you're not responsible for it. Maybe the owner told you about it in the soil samples and everything else, and you have to maybe do some stuff in your design to take that into consideration, or make recommendations that need to be abated, or whatever. But you don't, the property is the owner's problem. So if you design the building and they start digging it, like when we did Navy Pier, did I tell you about the radium? So when we were doing Navy Pier, I didn't know this, it happened. So in the front area of Navy Pier, they redid the whole turnaround circle, and there's a fountain and everything else where you go in and do turnaround. So, because I did the whole horizontal renovation of that over like an 8-year process. The hotel and the both wheels, the first one and the second one, everything else. So when they were digging up all the area in front of Navy Pier, and then we had done all these samples of the pier mostly going out, because it literally is on pilings that go down into the bottom of the lakefront. It's not on land. Some land though. But we started digging in and they found radon. And like, so it's a toxic substance. And so the Illinois EPA and the U.S. EPA, so the IEPA and the EPA came in and was like, you can't build, shut down. And we, because I represent Navy Pier, we were responsible for abating it. And it took a long time, but the area that we were working on was shut down. And this provision, the architect didn't know. So the architect had no responsibility, even though they were doing the designs for the area in front. What it turned out was back, I don't know if it was the 20s or 30s, maybe a little bit later, but if you go a little bit further east into the North Pier area, just east of like where Like, you know where North Pier Terminal is, that where the building is, and then there's the hotels and stuff. Like, that whole area was industrial, and they were building, and there was actually a watch factory there. And the watch factories back in the day, when you had a glow-in-the-dark face, those little glow-in-the-dark watch, that was all radon. And so when they had extra stuff, they would just dump it in front of the pier. So for years, they were dumping excess radon just, you know, a block away. And that came up and stalled out the Navy Pier project, and there was delays, and there was costs and everything else. And both because there's a similar provision for a contractor. We're not responsible for the land either. So in both instances, me, the architect and contractor, had any costs and those delays, we had to pay more to the architect and the contractor because the owner owns the land and the problems that come with it. So that's what 10-6 is. But I never knew that about, like, the areas where they were building, and it just because all the glow-in-the-dark things in your watch, just that it was the one factory that did that. 10-7, this is like, if you're doing this project, you do a really cool project, you want to make sure you can promote it. You want to tell everybody, hey, this is my stuff. So 10-7 says you're allowed to include photographs and artistic representation in your professional materials. How can you promote yourself? So by nature, the AIA gives you the right to promote your projects. Some clients will say, you can do that, but I need to have first approval of what you're going to be publishing. Some clients say, you can't publish it at all. Like, a lot of my high net worth people don't want their houses and interior of their houses out there on a website. Makes sense. So, the architect's materials, so that's the first part is owner architect gets to say, I can use this stuff. Owner gets a little bit push-pull, come back. You can't use confidential proprietary information. Like, I've never seen the inside of where the machines are where they make the candy in Haribo. Even their lawyer, they won't let me in because it's proprietary. So, I mean, I guess I could sign a waiver like all the workers that are working there, but nobody wants to, they don't want to see their equipment because it's all proprietary. So you can't have photographs of that. Although I was frustrated because about 4 or 5 months after the factory opened, there was a bit on the Today Show. And they showed this new, they were making this whole presentation because it's the first gummy bear factory in the United States. It's the biggest in the world. I'm like, that's my factory. And they had this really tight close-up of the machinery moving the gummy bears. And I'm like, wait, how did they get cameras in there? But you couldn't see anything because it was so tight. But I was like, you let the Today Show in, but you wouldn't let your lawyer in. But it's okay. I really like my client. But it's funny. I tease them about it. I'm like, come on, guys. Anyway, so this is the little pullback from the owner that says, you can't, the architect, you gotta be careful. You're not gonna put my proprietary information, and if you do, you need to have discussions about it. And then the owner, if the owner wants to put something up, a picture of their own place, the owner shall provide professional credit for the architect. Maybe it's on the project site. There's a big board where the building is being built, you know, constructed by Walsh and designed by, Gang Architecture, whatever. So, Genie Gang. But that's something that you ask them to do. Hey, promote me. You know, if you're going to use my photographs and my stuff, promote me. So that's a give and take for both sides. 10-8. Oh, if either side receives something that's mentioned as confidential proprietary, you got to hold it proprietary. So, and these again are provisions. It makes a lot of sense logically, but let's make a contractual requirement for it. So if somebody does release something proprietary, you can come back and say, you're in breach of 10-8. I have damages for that. Here's the provision. You knew the rules. Can't say I didn't know. You let the proprietary stuff out, so I'm going to sue you for that. Whatever. Questions on that? Okay. Compensation, this will be, there's a 12 and a 13, and I'll show you those really quickly, but for what the purpose, but the only thing left we got to do is 11, and then we have plenty of time to go through the questions. So how do we get paid? We got to get paid for all this stuff. Your basic services, your supplemental services, your additional services. Article 11 is your payment process, and there's kind of a mix and match. It's a little bit of a, I don't know if it's a shopping list, but you can pick and choose. There are basically three ways that an architect gets paid. One is called lump sum or stipulated sum. I will design your house for $50,000. And you get paid $50,000. Now, if you make changes and things go wrong, you can get some additional money. But if you just design the house and the house is stable and everything's good, and you said you're going to do it for $50,000, lump sum, stipulated sum, same thing. Second way. Hourly. I will design your house and I will charge you every hour that I work. That's what I do. My life is hourly work as a lawyer. And here's my hourly rate schedules. Principal, $350. Assistant principal, $275. Architect, you know, blah, blah, blah. Associate, junior associate, draftsman, whatever they are. And there's an hourly rate for each one. For every hour each one of these people work on your project, I will bill you that cost. Hourly. Pretty simple. The third was called percentage of the cost of the work. Your house is going to be $1 million. My fee is 7%. So I'm going to get $70,000 for your $1 million house. 7% of the cost of the work. Question? Yes, cost of the work, capital, defined term, correct. So it's not my services included, it's not the price of the land, it's not what they pay Hanahan to do the contracts, it's just the price of building the project, wherever the contractor comes back. That $1 million house that is the cost of the work budget, not the project budget. The project budget is always going to be higher. So you say, okay, well, what do you do if we have this house that is, I got $1 million budget, I'm going to do it for 7%, so I know I'm going to get $70,000. What happens if there's an addition? Well, if it goes to $1.1 million because you put on the deck and a garage, or you double your garage or whatever, it's trued up at the end. You ultimately get to the end. Whatever the final cost of the work is, if you haven't been paid enough over the time, you get that additional money. There's a provision here we'll talk about if it goes down, how that works. But, number one, architect's basic services under this article shall be compensated the architect as follows. And that's basically here, what's the amount and basis of. So here you're going to say cost of work, you're going to say lump sum, stipulate sum, hourly, you're going to tell what it is. You're going to say how we're going to do that. So that's the first one. We're doing this as a percentage of the cost of work. Then everybody knows what it is. 11.2. Architect supplemental services designed in section 411, that was that chart that we had, that blue chart. And for any sustainability services, these are like if you want to do LEED or green globes, which maybe is on that chart, or maybe it's something more that you did that's not necessarily on the chart, but they're not basic services, shall be compensated as follows. Often this is going to say hourly, because you don't know what those supplemental services are going to be until they're asked for. But maybe in the beginning of the contract you're negotiating and you're like, here's my basic services, which is architectural, structural, mechanical, and electrical. So we know those. Those are all basic. But you say, hey, you know what? I want you to do landscaping architecture. So you tell them in the beginning, and the owner gives, or the architect gives a price, but that'll be another $75,000. That could be a lump sum, so you could stick that in here. Hourly, but for the landscaping, that's $75,000. So whatever it is that you negotiated. So, but you leave at least the flexibility hourly in case stuff comes up later. For additional services that may arise during the course of the project, remember, additional services is you're already providing. I'm already giving you electrical, traditional electrical. Oh, but you want me to do high voltage, or low voltage lighting. That's an additional service. Or you want me to do the AV stuff. That's an additional, because it's the electrical for the AV. Whatever is not your traditional electrical, so it's an additional. Or you added a third bedroom and I have to do more electrical for that third bedroom. Additional services. So the compensation is as follows. Again, most of the time that's going to be hourly. Compensation for supplemental services of the architect's consultant. I didn't do the electrical in the house. I hired an electrical engineer. They're going to charge me, and I'm going to pass it on to you, plus a markup. I get a markup. So the electrical engineer charged me $30,000. I'm going to charge you $33,000 because I get a 10% markup. Why? Well, because they charge me and I have to pay them, so I have to carry that $30,000 cost at least for a month because I billed you and you're not going to pay me until after. That's number one. Number two, I have to deal with them. I have to do scheduling. I have to go back and forth with them. I have my time built into them back and forth, so I should get paid for that time. So when you're dealing with, when an architect uses one of those consultants, electrical engineer, mechanical engineer, whoever it is that the architect's not doing in-house, you get a markup. Markups generally range from 0 to 15%. I've seen 20 in some ways when you have a really specialty guy or a company, but majority is 5 or 10, but I've seen it anywhere from 0 to 20. As an owner, I always try to get 0. As an architect, I try to get 10. You see what happens. So that's all a business negotiation. Where the work is based on a stipulated sum or a percentage of the cost of the work, how do you get paid? So let's do it. We're doing that $1 million house for 7%. So it's 70 grand. Right? Am I doing that right all the time? Yeah, 70 grand. Do I get paid 70 grand right at the beginning? No. Because you're working along. So what we do is we say, down here, this chart, this will say 70 grand, or wherever the number is, so here or here, but the number will be 70 grand. And you break it up in percentages, so that it ultimately equals 100%. So traditionally these numbers, I gave you these before, schematic design phase is going to be around 10 to 15, design development is around 20, construction document phase is around 40 to 50. Bidding negotiation 5. This is going to go around 25 in the construction phase. And my math probably wasn't right when I was doing that in my head, but those are the general ranges in there. It's going to flow. You're normally the biggest one, as I said. And you will not be asked the question on the numbers on this exam. I have a slide for a later exam where we have the exact numbers, the percentage they do. There may be some math involved in the second half of the semester, but not for this. Just for your concept, that's how you build. I take that $60,000, $70,000 that we build, and I break that up into percentages so the owner knows the cash flow, and so do you. So this contract tells you how to do it, how to build. Six. When the compensation in 11.1 is on a percentage basis, because remember 11.1, you're going to see percentage, lump sum, or hourly. You're going to tell them in 11.1. So when you are on a percentage basis, progress payments for each base of the space shall be calculated by multiplying the percentages identified by the architect in the most recent budget for the cost of the work. So that budget was $1 million on the first day, but maybe as you're working and you're moving along, it goes to 1.1. So it allows your dollars to go up and down because if the budget changes, not your estimate, the owner's budget. So you can bill more than you maybe thought because the budget's gone up. The owner's like, oh, I want $1.5 million. Well, then your fee has gone up and you can build accordingly. You don't have to wait for the end to true up. 7.6.1. When the compensation is based on any portion of the work, the project are deleted. We had $1 million budget. I couldn't afford it. I got rid of the bathroom. Now it's a $900,000 budget. Do you get paid more or less or the same? You get paid the same if you've already done the design. If you design that 3-bedroom, 3-bath house and it's done, and then they pull back the third bathroom because the bids came in too much and they wanted to remove it, you get paid based on the cost of the work for the budget. You get paid on that budget because you did the work. Just because the owner is spending less money doesn't mean that you should be paid less money. You did the work. And if you have to remove that bathroom because you didn't do anything wrong, you should get paid because that wasn't your error, that was the owner's change. You should get paid for redesign to fix it. You didn't blow the budget, the owner changed its mind. So you should get paid your full fee plus the fix-it fee. So that's what this does, this protects you there. Question?
Is it common for, or is it possible for an owner to be like, instead of wanting to have the budget be higher, so they don't have to pay your more, that they would like, leave some work until after the argument is done? Like, if they'd be like, okay, now the budget is looking like it's going to be $1.2 million, so I'm not putting any of the finishes before I'm ready, and I'm able to be shown these abilities instead of content. I can do that without them. Or is that slightly?
So whether it's illegal or not, remember the term would be is a breach of contract.
Yeah.
So illegality. So when people say it's illegal, it's mostly criminal when you say it. But so let me see if I got the scenario right. I give you a budget. You design to my budget, and then I as the owner realize I need to build the house, and maybe I'm not going to finish out. It's a four bedroom, three bath house, but the fourth bedroom, you designed it for me, but I don't want to finish it out because my mother in law has it, it's still in her. She's spy mobile and she doesn't have to move in yet. You know, that's why we have this extra space, so it's just sitting there, and I haven't finished it out. But that would have been within the cost of the work, and if you're bidding off the cost of the work, the question is, can I, as the owner, wait and not pay you for the value of your services? Is that what you're asking?
No, but maybe you weren't the best for you.
Okay.
I think more in a situation like, okay, so I'm like, I have $1 million to buy this house, and you're going to get, let's say, 10%.
Yeah, 100%.
So then we go into it after something, and you're like, oh, well, we wish your numbers were small, whatever. It's actually going to cost like $1 million.
Right.
To build this house. And I don't want to pay that extra, like, $40,000 to you, or, like, $29,000 or whatever. So, can I just say, alright, I'm only spending $1 million, I'm only paying you $100,000, and after the work is, so don't worry about any of those, like, my day finishes, whatever, I'll deal with that later, even though it's in your original scope of work. Like, is it possible to reduce the project budget that is, like, under the purview of the architect,
yes, you can remove scope at any time because you're the owner, and the question of whether the architect should get paid for the removed scope or not comes down to, first, did they already do any of that scope? If they didn't, then obviously they don't get paid for it. But, second, if when you remove that scope, it does affect the other building, so you have to, like, maybe that whole area, this is an example that I had that actually really happened, is we had a very, it was a high net worth person, they had a 6 or 7 car garage, and there was a very large space over the garage that was going to be built out at one point in time for a children's play area. So it was going to have, like, a whole bunch of stuff in there. And like, so they designed all the electrical, they didn't design all the electrical for that yet, because it was listed as NIC, not in contract. So they knew that space was going to be like that. But they ended up having the way the electrical and other things and the connections that needed to be made for that, it had to be modified because it was going to sit there and not do anything, because it was still going to be open surface. So while there was no design in the open space, the architect, to still complete the project, had to do modifications to the design of the base house. The architect would be paid for that correction of the design for the base house. And the owner, even though we had talked about that, and at one point in time we wanted to have this all decked out and above the garage, but you had never done the work, you don't get paid for that, but you do get paid for buttoning up what you need to do. So that's how you would deal with that. So yes, the owner can always reduce scope. And depending on where the architect is in the process, they may or may not get paid. And then there may be, though, an additional payment due to the architect or the contractor to make sure that change is properly wrapped up. You don't want to have open circuits and all that other stuff. So this was principally an electrical issue, but it wasn't a lot, but we paid the architect for it. So, does that answer your question?
Yeah.
Okay, good. Okay. Yeah, at the end of the day, the owner can always do whatever they want, and then you use the contract to figure out who they have to pay or don't have to pay. The owner can say, no, I don't want any of this stuff, but somebody did, they got to pay them. Expectation damages. Or reliance. Okay. That's those. 11.7. Hourly billing rates for the architect and the architect's consultants shall be as follows, and you put this in here, or you do an attachment. Everybody knows what they are, and then in the attachment, if you're an architect, you're going to say, here's our rates, they go up every year annually, we'll give you notice 30 days in advance, yada, 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 to tell them what happens. So everybody knows that on January 1st, they're going to be more expensive. Did you have a question? Okay. Compensation for reimbursable expenses. So reimbursable expenses can be, and we're going to go through this list, but also like your consultant. The consultant is reimbursable because they charge you and you're going to get reimbursed for the owner. But traditional reimbursable expenses, transportation, long distance services, fees paid if you have to get like permitting, printing and reproduction, postage, overtime, the traditional things that are running a business. You get all of that in addition to your hourly rates. None of this is built into the hourly rate. So you're going to have this on your bill, you're going to have cost of your services, here's my hourly rates, or here's my percentage, or whatever it is, and you're going to say, here's all the expenses I have. You know what, we drive to go pick up this furniture, we had to fly out to this, like I had an architect that said they had to go to Italy like every month for like 6 months to pick out marble because they needed it for this upscale apartment in New York. So every flight, and then you build into it, the flights are going to be like, I had one guy that only would fly first class. And other times it's like, I had one guy that he agreed when we negotiated that he would fly commercial, but he would never sit in the middle seat. And he would never sit in the back economy. So he had to be, you know, economy plus, but never in the middle seat. So if that cost him more, he had to pay for that. So all those things. Renderings and models are reimbursable expenses, professional liability insurance that is built in. The owner pays for your insurance. Taxes, site office expenses, other project-related stuff. So these are all, you can pass those along. They're not included in your lump sum. They're not included in your percent complete. They're not included in your hourly. They are a different line item. And under 11.8.2, reimbursable expenses plus 10% markup. Again, same thing. I see 5, 10, 15 here. Most of the time it lands, hopefully, for an architect around 10. If it's an owner, zero, but whatever you want to do, whatever you can get. But same thing. So if I'm using a consultant, I get the consultants plus, reimbursable expenses plus, because I'm, my work, my leverage, my carrying costs. Makes sense. And then finally, compensation for use of instruments of service. If the owner terminates the architect for convenience, I don't like your tie, go away. Or the architect terminates under 9.3, you have suspended the project more than 90 days. I am going somewhere else because my A team wants to work elsewhere. The owner shall pay a licensing fee as compensation for the owner's continued use of the instruments of service solely for the purposes of completing, using, and maintaining the project. Not for adding to. Remember that other one had adding to. The license, so the license is now restricted, but they have to pay a license fee. So if the architect says, you've suspended too many times, and I'm going to terminate, because I'm just, it's not working out, so it's not a convenience, I'm allowed to do it under 9.3, that could put the owner in a pretty dire strait because they can't finish the project. And it's not their fault. It's just the financing just wasn't there, and the architect said, I got to move along. But the drawings were finished, or the drawings were halfway done. So instead of the architect completely leaving the owner out the cold and have to start all over, the owner's allowed to pay a licensing fee. Or if we terminated for our convenience and we still want to use that, we can pay a licensing fee. So remember I told you that project we had phase one and phase two? We paid the architect that designed both phases and only worked on phase one. We paid them a high six-figure licensing fee to bring somebody else into work on phase two. So this helps the architect, but also protects the owner. This is a nice balancing provision so people aren't economically cut off their needs.
Are there cases that owners like the design of an architect, so they use that just for only the design,
pay them
the licensing, but prefer to work with another architect for the oversight?
Great question. So the question is, you guys in here, is, are there situations where the owner hires the architect for design services only, but then has another architect that would be effectively the architect of record for administering the contract and making sure it's built properly and everything else? The answer is yes. And in fact, there are actually AIA forms specifically for that. And I have, we're kind of on a holding pattern right now, but I had one before the first of the year, and that there's a situation I've had a half a dozen of those in my career, where you bring in an architect, like one, I had one in my, one 6 or 8 years ago, and the architect was a French architect, wasn't licensed in the state, but the owner was for a private residence, and the owner just loved their work, and so they were the design architect. And we hired an architect of record here. The architect was licensed in the state of New York where the project was being built. Based on that whole holding out, or the holding out statute, or the licensing practice statute that we had in earlier lectures, that U.S. architect worked hand in glove with the French architect, so the U.S. architect could seal the drawings. And the French architect would come on site every once in a while, but was not responsible for any of the legal stuff, just the designs. Yes, that happens. We use AA forms for that. I have some forms that I've done that are separate, that are like a bespoke form that we created ourselves, but that happens. It's not as often, and it's often, and when it does, it's when you're in a situation where it's a licensing issue. They aren't licensed in the area, so you got to get your local. But yes, that happens. So, questions on this? Termination and how the termination fee. Okay. 11:10. Payments to the architects. How do you get paid? Sometimes they just want a down payment. Like, give me $10,000 to start. So of that $70,000, give me 10, and I'm going to have an initial payment. So we lock that in. So everybody knows that the rest of it's only going to be 60 grand. Thus otherwise, payment shall be made monthly. So it just says, you know, send me a bill every month. So nothing complicated or outrageous in this. Pretty standard. But you put in the contracts, you know what the process is going to happen. 11:10:3, owner shall not withhold amounts from the architect's compensation to impose a penalty or liquidated damage on the architect. Second part is probably more important. Or to offset sums requested paid to contractors for changes in the work, unless the architect agrees or has been found liable for the amounts finding in dispute, in binding dispute resolution. So, what can happen on a project, let's say we have a $500,000 fee to the architect, and the last $100,000 is going to be paid to the architect for their project management oversight during the building, the construction portion of the project. And you paid the architect like $350,000, you're not quite at the $400,000, they've just sent their last invoice for the construction documents to get those done, got the permit, the contractor started working, and there's some problems that go on in the field, and some things are wrong with the drawings, or there's a question about whether they're right with the drawings, and the contractor says the drawings are terrible. Architect says no, they're not. So there's this dispute. This provision says, if you did the drawings and you sent it to me, unless I can show you and there's binding dispute resolution, I have to pay you for your work. It's different with contractors. In contractors, there's language that says you can withhold it, and it's much easier to withhold money from the contractor than from the architect. This is very good for you guys as an architect. You can pay for your work. And the only way the owner is allowed to withhold that money is if there is a, you agree, yeah, I screwed up, so you don't have to pay me that full amount, or there's binding dispute resolution, meaning we've had an arbitration, we've had a court of law that says you don't get that money. So it puts the owner in the position of having to claw back the money. If the judgment goes in favor of the owner has to get the money back from the architect. This basically says, if you do your work and you bill on time and you send it to us, we get paid for our work. It's later that we figure out if my work was improper or not. Now, obviously, you guys don't want to do crappy work anyway, so you should always get paid. But this protects you. That's not to say that the owner won't do this. Because the owner will do this. And they'll hedge their bets and say, they're not going to sue me on this because it's going to be more expensive to sue me for the $50,000 that I'm holding back to get things sorted out and slow up payment than it is for them to sue me and pay the legal fees and everything else. So the owner will still do it and still be in breach of contract. It's a leverage piece the owner does. So I'm not saying it doesn't happen, but at least the contract protects you. And so when you get projects that are bigger and bigger and bigger, maybe that lawsuit becomes worth it. Maybe it's worth it to terminate. Maybe it's worth it to suspend services. There's some remedies that you have in Article 9 to protect you. But technically, the owner cannot hold back money if you've done your work. So that's good for you. Any questions on payment? All right, really quick. Article 12. If you have any special terms and conditions, stick it here. So if we have other stuff, stick it here. That's all Article 12 is. I got like 15 provisions I stick in Article 12. We're not going to worry about those. But I got a bunch of them that I stick in. Article 13 says, this is the entire integrated agreement between the parties. It supersedes everything else, meaning this is our contract. If we chatted, we had other stuff before this one is the written document. This is what we are. And we're going to use the B101, or we're going to use the E201, or whatever the documents are going to use. And here's the attachments. Schedule, rates, hourly rates, whatever. So that's what 13 is. 13 is just says, here's the list of documents that follow this. And that's the end of the B101. Questions? All right. Why don't you guys take a break? And then we'll come back, we'll do those six questions. I can talk a little bit more about the exam. And get another donut if you need one.